Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all. My name is Tricia Griffith and this is Tricia's True Crime Radio. And yes, I am broadcasting from a cave and I have joined the Taliban. Actually, I'm just using a different computer tonight. And of course, it couldn't be operator error. Never, never would that be. Tonight's show is sponsored by a wonderful group of people called Pause for Purple Hearts in Palo Alto, California. Pause for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind to offer therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder to train service dogs for their comrades with combat-related injuries. All you need to do is go to www.pauseforpurplehearts.org. Okay, once again, Sunday night, a little past 8 Eastern, it's time for that gooey stuff we call legal goo. Opinions expressed on Tricia's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Tricia's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuth.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. There you go. Okay, today we're going to talk about two mysteries and one controversial issue. Later in the show, we'll have Dan Harrington on. Dan's daughter, Morgan Harrington, on October 17, 2009, went missing. Morgan and three of her friends drove to the John Paul Jones Arena to see a rock concert. Morgan went to the restroom and was never seen alive again. Her body was found 4 years ago today. Now, Dan will update us on his daughter's case, and I will tell you, when you hear from Dan Harrington, you will be inspired at what Dan and his wife Jill have done for all missing children out there. They are an amazing couple. We'll be speaking with Dan in just a little bit, but first, where is Talika Patrick? That is the question. Talika is a brilliant woman, a doctor. Actually, she just vanished on December 5th. But as we have found out, Talika Patrick was fighting mental illness. She had this bizarre delusion that she was married to a gospel singer. So she was so sure their marriage was real, Dr. Patrick moved from California to Michigan to be closer to him. Talika even approached his children. Now, finally, the gospel singer, Marvin Sapp, got a restraining order against Talika. And by the way, the police say absolutely Marvin did not have anything to do with Talika's disappearance whatsoever. So there's a lot more to this story, because on December 5th, Talika Patrick just seemed to vanish into thin air. And here to help us sort out what we have so far is Julie Mack. Julie Mack has been, in my opinion, the number one reporter on this case for the Kalamazoo Gazette and MLive Online. Julie, welcome to Tricia's True Crime Radio. Hold on 1 second. There we go. Welcome. How are you?
I am doing fine. Thank you for having me on.
Good. Thank you very much. Could you speak up just a little bit for me, okay?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just kind of like when you're yelling at your cat.
Okay. Yeah.
There we go. Okay, let's just talk a little bit. Let's start from the beginning here, because there's some people listening, I'm sure, that don't know everything behind the Talika Patrick case. So let's start with Talika being in California. She's graduated. Where did her life start taking this bizarre turn? Tell us a little bit about Talika and then how it came to be that she moved to Michigan.
Well, a little bit of backstory. She actually grew up in Queens, New York. She is the oldest daughter of Jamaican immigrants, very hardworking, very ambitious family. She went to the New York School of Science, or the Bronx School of Science, which is a very competitive, one of the top high schools, public high schools in the United States, really. Was offered a full ride to Harvard, we understand, actually turned it down to go to a small private college, Seventh-day Adventist school. Went to Chicago, or went to California to get Loma Linda University to get her MD and her PhD. She is very, very bright. She graduated in the spring, and she was starting a medical residency in Kalamazoo here with the Western Michigan School of Medicine. And she actually said that she, in her own writings, she has said that she took this. So she actually didn't think she was married to Marvin Sapp. She thought that they were engaged. She thought it would be future husband. But she did think that the two of them were in love, that they had a telepathic connection, and that God was telling her that this was her going to be her future husband. So that was how she came here, was because, and she actually could have gone, you know, to like John Hopkins or Harvard or something like that, but it was because of this compulsion with Marvin Sapp that she came here.
So she's here, and what do we know that she actually did to Marvin Sapp's family or to him personally? She approached his kids. Were they in grade school, grown up? What's that situation?
He is a widower. He is not married right now. His wife died in 2010. He has three teenage children. I know that one turned 16, so they're teenagers. And I think the oldest one is 19. We don't know exactly. First of all, we do know that she just buried him, I think, in letters, videos, pictures. She was sending a lot of initially, emails, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. As I'm sure we'll talk more about later, she was doing a lot of social media, Twitter and on Facebook, and she was doing a lot on there. But we do know that she showed up to his house at least once, and he wasn't there, and talked to his kids. He is also a minister in Grand Rapids, a very well-known minister of one of the biggest churches in West Michigan. She joined that church, and I know she was chatting up the kids at church too. So she was pretty persistent. There's in one of her tweets, she talked about how she showed up to his office unannounced and hung out for the day. We actually had a story a couple weeks ago about he actually called her out one day during a service and said he was being stalked by a woman and that he was and he couldn't take it anymore and she needed to be driven out of the congregation. And that happened actually a month before he took a restraining order out on her. And on the same day he took the restraining order, he also had a letter written by his church board telling her that she could not go to that church anymore.
So she really did. I'm sure she frightened him tremendously, don't you think?
Well, and actually, I don't want to get into it too much, but if you read her tweets, she was, I mean, there's no evidence that he ever contacted her or responded to her overtures. You know, he knew who she was, obviously, because she was flooding him with all this stuff, but there's no evidence that he was responding to her. And, in fact, one reason we know that is because she says repeatedly in her own writing, he never calls, he never writes, he never contacts me back except telepathically. But she maintains in detail in her tweets that he was confessing very serious things to her about his finances, about his home life, and I'm sure that scared Jesus out of him, about his health. She was making some accusations that she was saying that he had telepathically confessed these things to her, and they were slanderous things. So I'm sure that was very scary to him. I'm not sure that he was aware of all that, but if he was monitoring her social media accounts, that would have just been very frightening.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking with Julie Mack, and we're talking about the very bizarre story of Talika Patrick, who went missing on December 7th. We also have Michael in Minnesota, my wonderful co-host, who knows how to jump in and rescue me when I'm choking. Don't you, Michael?
Hopefully.
Thank you. Hopefully. So we've gotten to where Talika Patrick came to Minnesota to be closer to this person. And you did something Michigan. Did I say Minnesota again? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I told you. I'm just losing my mind. Michigan. And, Julie, you wrote a story that was very interesting about this type of mental illness that Talika Patrick appears to have been suffering from. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, first of all, it's very important to note that she has never been diagnosed with a mental illness. It's important that we don't, start putting labels on her because we don't know exactly what was going on. But we do know that from her own writing, she started experiencing delusions, like hearing voices and stuff when she was an undergrad, so like more than a decade ago. And that was confirmed. Her ex-husband, she was married for a time in California. He said he thought that she had an undiagnosed mental illness. And, in fact, they divorced because he insisted that she get psychiatric help, and she refused. And she refused, really, because she was a brilliant woman, and she thought it would derail her career. So she would not do that. But there is a type of sort of a subcategory that sometimes when people have a serious mental illness like bipolar or schizophrenia or other, you know, some other serious condition and are experiencing delusions, it can develop into something called erotomania. And mm-hmm. erotomania is a fixation on usually a stranger. It's usually someone who is famous or quasi-famous, as was this gospel singer in Grand Rapids. And they think that, you know, that the two of them are in love, and despite all evidence to the contrary, even, mm-hmm. you know, and I interviewed a psychiatrist from the University of Michigan about this, and he said, when someone is experiencing this, it is not a logical thing. It is a delusion in the same way mental other delusions are, mental illness. And there is a fixation, is a, what he called it, a firm fixed idea that is not subject to logic or reason. So it's not, you know, other people telling her, you know, that, as I think her siblings did, we've never met him. You've, you know, there's no evidence that he wants to have a relationship with you. That just isn't going to work because it is not, she's an experience, when someone is having this, they're experiencing a delusion. And it's almost like having a short in your brain.
It is. She literally, if this is what she had, these people can't control it. It's what is in there. It's as clear and as real to them as everybody out there sitting and listening to this show. And that's what we have to remember, because I think a lot of times, especially with mental illness, we think, well, come on, just, you know, look at the reality right here in front of you. Well, you have to understand, literally, their brain is not firing properly. And it sounds like we can all play armchair psychiatrists, and, you know, we're not trying to diagnose her, but it certainly sounds like this is a very real possibility that she had this illness. And what was it called again?
It was called erotomania. And it actually, someone had sent to me a study where someone had actually had this delusion about the same person for 34 years. I mean, it can last a really long time, and depending on how someone reacts to it. But, you know, like telling someone to snap out of it, it's like telling a diabetic, you know, just sort of will your blood sugar to be right, or,
yeah.
you know, telling... I mean, it really is sort of like that. This is not a matter of a bad character or a lack of will. It really is a neurobiological malfunction.
It absolutely is. Michael in Minnesota, I got that right this time, you have a question for Julie Mack. We're talking about the Talika Patrick case. Go ahead, my dear.
Yes, I sure do. First of all, hi, Julie. Thank you. You're very good, and I appreciate your storytelling abilities. Wonderful. I have a two-part question. First of all, how large was Talika's family of siblings? You mentioned her siblings. And when they were seeing these tweets that were obviously delusional, did anyone try ever to intervene in the 10 years plus that these she was showing these symptoms? And if not, why? It seems like such a tragedy that such a brilliant mind was allowed to spiral into pure chaos without anyone who knew or loved her intervening. So it's a two-part question.
These are really good questions. So, okay, so the first question is, she has two parents, and she has a brother and a sister. She has the younger brother, younger sister. One thing that's important to realize is it seems like a close family, but it also is a spread-out family. She went to college, went from living in New York, where she was living with her family, to college in Alabama. She hasn't lived near her family in 13 years. Her brother lives in New York. Her sister lives in Boston. Her parents live in Florida. So, you know, we're talking, you know, weekly phone call or, you know, it was probably fairly easy for her to hide her issues, because they weren't around her on a daily basis. But the other issue, too, is that this wasn't going on for, you know, a decade straight. It's important to realize this. It was very sporadic. It would happen. She would get a handle on it. It sounds like the issue in undergrad, she told, like, one person about it, and she was actually able to control it on her own. She says she did it by, she went to see A Beautiful Mind, the movie about a brilliant mathematician, John Nash.
Yeah.
And that he just trained himself to turn the voices, you know, not, okay, I'm going to have voices in my head. I just have to ignore those voices. And she trained herself to not listen to the voices anymore. So she moves out to California, was in a marriage that sounded a bit rocky, had started having maybe some issues again, but and he confronted her, and she divorced him. So she didn't sound like someone who really wanted to hear that things weren't going well. And in Kalamazoo, I mean, I think the fact that she, so it starts up again in earnest in Kalamazoo, but once again, she's not close to, she's not physically near her family, and her coworkers don't know her that well. Now, the tweets thing is really interesting. She was doing a thing where she would, just an incessant tweeter. And actually, the guy from U of M said this is not uncommon with someone who has erotomania, that they're just obsessively writing to or about the person. And they said a lot of times it's discovered because someone in the family will find like this, you know, big stack of unsent letters or something. In her case, she was just tweeting. But she would tweet and she would delete the tweets, okay? So the tweets have been recovered, but I think that she didn't, she was tweeting under a different name. I don't know that her family was even seeing these tweets. Now, she did last spring tell her siblings, the reason I'm moving to Kalamazoo, the reason I'm not going to Harvard or Johns Hopkins is because of this guy. And they were sort of like, huh, well, that doesn't seem very smart. But, you know, it's an older sibling. She's 30 years old. I mean, you know, that's one of the things the guy from, all the people who I interviewed last week said. You know, you can have a family member who's experiencing delusions, but you can't force them to get help. You know, if you tell someone that that sounds crazy, and they say, no, it's not, well, where do you go from there?
That's true, that you are left with absolutely no options. Let's talk about the tweets and the videos, if we can. Tell us, and I'm just saying this as a proud co-owner here, but Julie, tell us who found them. How were they found? Give us that scoop.
Well, that is a very interesting story because the story went along for a couple of weeks. This story was initially presented as, you know, this brilliant doctor disappears, and it sounded like she might have been kidnapped or something. And we were asking, are there mental health issues? Because it's a logical question that you ask when people disappear. And we were told, well, she's never been diagnosed. She's not on medication. You know, maybe she was under stress because she's in a medical residency, but it didn't sound like that there were mental health issues. However, there were people on Web Sleuths, the website that Tricia co-owns, who were looking into her social media footprints. And she, as many people are in that age, was an incessant user of social media and of going online. And they were sort of, and there were people who are on Web Sleuths who actually do this for a living. You know, they track down credit card fraud or they're IT experts, and they knew how to do it. So they're following her social footprints, and they first came across these sort of these videos, strange videos that she had made to where she's talking directly to her smartphone, to her iPhone, and she's like talking to an unnamed love interest, you know, just sort of declaring her devotion. But she's also like making a meal for two and showing the preparations for this meal and sort of sitting down to eat it, and the other person isn't there. It was very, if you look at it, it was sort of like, huh, what's that about? Particularly when these videos surfaced that the Web Sleuthers found, and they ended up getting on mainstream media, the family said initially, well, she's not dating anyone. We don't know who these videos are for. So that was really bizarre. And those videos were posted in November, just before she disappeared. Well, the Web Sleuthers continued to tease that out, and then came across, were able to figure out her Twitter handles. She had deleted all her Twitter accounts before she had disappeared. But they were able to tease out various Twitter handles, and then they were able to figure out a way to recover her. There's actually, a search engine online that anybody can use, that if you know someone's Twitter handle, you can retrieve all their tweets, and that's exactly what they did. So they ended up recovering 20,000 Twitter posts between April and the time she disappeared. And it was like, really, it was like having someone's diary. She really poured her heart and soul into these tweets that she would then delete. She would tweet and delete, tweet and delete. And so people weren't reading them until now. But it really spells out the whole thing with the delusions and the voices and the obsession with Marvin Sapp and the fact, I mean, a lot of what we know is because of she just I mean, I accidentally printed this out at work. It was over 800 pages of tweets.
And isn't that sad, Julie? We're talking with Julie Mack, reporter for the Kalamazoo Gazette and also the MLive, the online version. And we're talking about Talika Patrick and about how members of Web Sleuths were able to go in and find all these tweets and videos that she had deleted. She didn't want them out there, but, you know, it is a privacy issue, but they were found by members of Web Sleuths. And it was absolutely, truly amazing how they were able to come across all of these and pull them up so quickly. I am co-owner, but I got to tell you, I am amazed every single day at what these people on Web Sleuths are able to do. But reading those tweets and watching those videos, she is just pouring her heart. Talika Patrick is pouring her heart out to whoever she is talking to. We don't know who it is, but I almost feel a little embarrassed, like I've got somebody's diary that I found and I'm reading it. But it always just amazes me what they have been able to uncover. So now let's talk about that night she went missing, Julie. Tell us what we know from beginning until the very latest on her disappearance. Take us through that night and what we know happened to Talika Patrick.
Right. Reading up to this, reading her tweets, you can see that she is mentally, emotionally sort of deteriorating through the fall. She got the PPO, the personal protection order from SAP in late September. So in October and November, her tweets really swing between, I love you, we're going to be together, I know this is just a ruse for you to fend off our enemies, and, you know, I'll never leave you, to really despair. She, you know, I don't know what's going on, and, you know, I moved here to be with you, and you don't want to be with me, and I just don't understand. So you can see that she's getting more upset, more frustrated. She talks about being depressed, clinically depressed, and she was actually, I didn't mention this before, but she was actually in a psychiatric medical residency, so she knew depression. She mentions taking a drug that was given to schizophrenics, so she, on some level, sort of maybe guessed what was going on. The day before she disappeared, she tweeted about being pursued by demons. So the day she disappeared, she worked a shift that day at Borges Medical Center, which is the hospital in Kalamazoo that has the psychiatric facility. Actually, her coworkers said she seemed to be fine that day. But at the end of the shift, she told a coworker that she had lost her wallet and she needed to borrow $100, and she needed to ride downtown. Gave her a ride downtown, and she has to be dropped off at a Radisson Hotel, actually the nice hotel in downtown. And he did that. She went in. We actually have video without sound, but the surveillance cameras, we have it posted online on MLive.com if anybody's interested. You can see her going into the lobby. She's talking to the desk clerk for 15 minutes. We're told that during that conversation, she was acting confused and erratic. Also, the person who drove her downtown said she said some things that he thought were a little strange and off the wall. She acted like she wanted to get a room, but she only had the cash. She didn't have an ID. She didn't have a credit card. She didn't have enough money for the room. So finally, you know, she's talking with the front clerk, and he says, well, what if we gave you a ride back to the hospital and you could get your wallet? And she says, yes, let's do that. So she does. The shuttle driver takes her back to the hospital, which isn't that far from the hotel. But when she gets to the hospital, she hops out and says, well, I'm sorry, I can't go back with you. And he watches her get in the car and leave. And that's actually the last anyone saw her where they knew it was her. So what happened after that is she drives out of the parking lot. 2 hours later, about 100 miles from Kalamazoo. Kalamazoo is exactly halfway between Detroit and Chicago. And she was driving on the major highway linking those two cities. So on her way to Chicago, she was driving toward Chicago on I-94. She hits, Northern Indiana. The state police in Indiana got a call that there was a car driving erratically. Almost immediately after that, they got another couple of calls saying a car had gone off the road into a ditch, and they got there. It was her car. She was not there. She had vanished. They found her wallet. They found her ID. They found her credit cards, but not her and not her car keys. So the question is, what happened? Was she in a delusional state and run off into the woods, or did she go to the road and get picked up by somebody, or did she walk somewhere?
Here's the thing. We're talking with Julie Mack. She is with the Kalamazoo Gazette, writing about the Talika Patrick case. Also, we have Michael in Minnesota, my wonderful co-host. And, Julie, here's the thing. My understanding is they did bring in dogs, but it was like a week later, as you have said before.
It was exactly a week later.
And the dogs – oh, go ahead. No, you go. You know more than I do.
Yeah,
tell
the
me.
Dogs actually did track a scent. Well, it was one dog. It was one dog. And that dog tracked a scent from where the car would have been to where the road was. Now, when we were told this by the state police, I will actually say, although you said I've been the best reporter on this, I have to definitely give a shout-out to my colleague Rex Hall, who's really the lead reporter in our newspaper on this. I have done a lot of the tweets and stuff, but mm-hmm. he has been the person who has really done a lot of the interviews, and he's done a terrific job. When he talked to the Indiana State Police about this, they did say, well, it was a week later. So it is a tool. It is interesting that the dog did that, but that's not exact confirmation that that's exactly what happened, because it was
but
a
it's
week
the
old
only,
trail.
Julie, it's the only thing that we have, really. But here's the thing. Was it not raining that night or shortly after? And could it just be maybe the scent was just washed away? And let me add to this multi-tiered question. When you say, could she have run off into the woods, were there woods there? Wasn't it kind of difficult to get to the woods? So go ahead. Take whichever part first.
Right. I mean, there are pros and cons. I mean, so the question is did somehow she leave that car area and get deposited somewhere else, or is she still there and had succumbed to the elements? The argument that she had got picked up, one is the dog did find a scent that went from the car to the road and then it stopped. So that tells you that you know, she may have indeed gotten picked up. There are some barriers to her running out. There are woods, and she could have run off. But when I was talking to the sheriff about this, he points out that there is a fence that separates the public access area from the land beyond it. Now, it is not actually Webb Sleuthers posted a picture of that fence today. It is basically just sort of a thin wire fence. It was actually to keep like deer and other animals from running from the woods into the highway. Mm-hmm. So it is not a strong fence. Someone could have climbed over it. It was not a huge barrier, but it was a barrier. But the terrain wasn't exactly flat. She would have had to go up and down. And so, you know, it was not an easy access to the land beyond the public access area. But
so,
she could have gotten, but the easier thing would have been for her to have gotten picked up.
Right. Let me back up just a little bit, because a lot of people have brought up this, and I want to clear it up. There was a phone call, supposedly, that's been reported on that Talika Patrick received while she was at work. And it looked like, if I'm not mistaken, that she became very upset. Haven't they found out recently that this phone call just really was nothing?
Right. We first heard about the phone call when Rex actually interviewed her parents. Her parents flew in from Florida to help do the search. He had an interview with them, and they said, wow, you know, we heard about this phone, you know, they've been told about this phone call she'd gotten on the day before she disappeared that seemed to really upset her, and they thought that might be a major clue. And it turned out, actually they talked about this at the press conference on Wednesday. They had a press conference on Wednesday, and they said it was from another family member who had gotten to a destination, and they'd gotten there safely. And they said it really was no big deal. It turned out not to be a nothing. So, you know, that wasn't
that was good. That we all we're hanging our hats onto that, that, oh, my gosh, she got this phone call. This is the big clue. And when the Sheriff's Department had this press conference, it was the biggest buildup up to absolutely nothing that I have ever seen. Basically, they held a press conference to say, we don't have anything to say at this press conference, is kind of what it looked like to me. Did anything come out of that press conference, really, that the sheriff held?
You know, they definitely fleshed out some things. We didn't know. I mean, the biggest thing is we, up until the press conference, we knew someone had taken her to the Radisson. She'd been at the Radisson, and then a shuttle driver had taken her back to the car. We had nobody was talking about, so what was her demeanor during that time? What did she say? Question is, she had an apartment that was fairly close to the hospital. Why would she try to book a room at the Radisson when she had this apartment? You know, why did she borrow $100? I mean, there were a lot of questions about her demeanor that night, and they did talk about that actually at length. And they did, what they said is that she was behaving in a confused and erratic manner, and it really wasn't clear why she wanted to book a hotel room, or if she wanted to at all, really. So that was actually news. And actually, another piece of news that came out of the press conference was they said Marvin Sapp is not a suspect; he's just a victim of stalking. There wasn't big news, but there were definitely pieces of news that came out that sort of fleshed out the story.
Well, that's better than anything, I guess. Better than nothing. We're talking with Julie Mack. We're talking about the very strange case of missing Dr. Talika Patrick. In just a little bit, we'll have Dan Harrington on, and Dan will talk about his lovely, wonderful daughter, Morgan, her disappearance, her murder. We'll find out the latest in all of that coming up in just a little bit. But we're wrapping it up here with Julie Mack about Dr. Talika Patrick. So where do we stand? What is the absolute latest thing that we know about Talika Patrick?
Well, let's see. I would say that what we really know that we probably didn't know last week at this time is that the working theory of police investigators is that she was undergoing some kind of mental breakdown, they think,
mm-hmm.
and was experiencing some delusions that night, they think, and so now they're thinking probably their best theory is that she is alive. They have searched the area, so they don't think she's near the car, but they can't totally rule that out because the weather has been so brutal here. There's been lots of snow since she disappeared, so they really can't search that area anymore. But it is possible that she is sort of just gone off the grid, that for whatever reasons she doesn't want to be found. What they are comparing this case to is the person who, you may have heard of, Tricia, there was a guy in his 20s who disappeared in upstate New York around Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
A week later, he had had some kind of mental breakdown, I think, and a week later he was found as a homeless person in Washington, D.C.
That's right.
His picture was on the front page of USA Today depicting homeless people trying to stay warm. And they're hoping something like that will help resolve this case, that maybe she's living somewhere and, just trying to keep a low profile.
Let's hope and pray that is it, because that would be wonderful. And hopefully it is sooner rather than later. Julie Mack, what can we expect from you? Any more interesting articles, not necessarily about Talika, but anything else coming up?
Well, I think that we still have another story that we're going to pursue about Talika that we're sort of in the planning stage right now. I don't think our coverage is done with this. There's a lot of interest in this case.
Let's talk about that for a minute. I mean, do you find it surprising how many people are interested in this case? I do. I'm not surprised. Let me rephrase that. I was at the beginning, but when I saw all the tweets and all the videos, I understand how this can just grab people's hearts.
You know, here's one thing that is heartening, is the fact that, and actually I haven't mentioned it, Talika Patrick is an African, she's Jamaican, but she is a person mm-hmm. of color. And I think so often missing people cases that involve people of color tend to get ignored by a lot of people.
Yes, you unfortunately.
Know, you know, sort of the Natalie Holloway syndrome, you know what I mean, that if you're not
mm-hmm.
Blue-eyed and blonde, you know, people are going to blow past it. So the fact
right.
that people have gravitated towards this case, I think, is somewhat heartening that, you know, and I think part of it is the fact that she is such an accomplished person.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, and well, there's one reason she is so accomplished. I mean, to have anybody who is an MD and a PhD and just being turn up missing, I think
mm-hmm.
is.
Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. Hold on one second, Dan.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I just accidentally put our next guest live on the air. Sorry about that, Dan. Just a minute. Anyway, it is a very fascinating case. So we will definitely keep following this. And, Julie, I'm sure we're going to have you back on very, very soon.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you, Julie. You take care, everybody. Julie Mack with the
okay.
Kalamazoo Gazette and MLive.com. You can't miss her. She has been right on top of this case. Michael, isn't she interesting? She is, oops, let me see, is Michael here? Yes. Michael, are you there?
I'm here. Yep,
okay,
I'm here.
Wasn't she absolutely fascinating?
Well, she knows the case inside and out, and I'm encouraged that they at least think that there's hope Talika is alive.
That's
I just
exactly
really
it.
Hope that she can be found and get the help that she so obviously desperately needs.
Absolutely.
I hate stories like this. This is just
I know. It's very, it is. And we're going to talk right now with a man, I greatly admire him. He is amazing. He and his wife, Jill, have taken a horrible tragedy and have done a lot to raise awareness for missing people in the States, and that is Dan Harrington. Dan, welcome to Tricia's True Crime Radio.
Thank you so much for having me tonight. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, it is absolutely our pleasure. And Dan, at the beginning of the show, I just gave a quick rundown of what happened. Your lovely daughter, Morgan, went to a rock concert. I think it was, was it Pantera? I can't remember the name.
No,
anyway,
Metallica,
that's right. She was wearing a Pantera t-shirt, that's right.
That's right.
And she went to the concert. She asked to go to, she went to go to the bathroom. She ended up outside. They wouldn't let her back in because in those shows they don't let people go in and out because they don't want them bringing, you know, drugs or whatever in. So she wasn't allowed back inside. Her friends called her. She said, don't worry about me. I'll hitchhike home. And that was the end of it. Is that pretty much the case or have I, is something not correct in that story?
No, I think that's sort of the gist of it. We don't know for sure why Morgan left the arena. And we have some suspicion that she actually had fallen and perhaps had an injury to her head. She was bleeding, actually, from her face. And when she was outside, you know, there was really, they didn't let her in. And her friend ultimately called her, who was with her in the arena, and said, Morgan, where are you? And she said she would find a ride home. Well, you know, home was 2.5 hours away. And
mm-hmm.
actually Morgan's car was there, so none of this really makes any sense. But ultimately, we think that she was looked like she was hitchhiking, actually, on the bridge leading away from the arena. And someone actually spotted her, and that was the last time that anyone saw her alive. And actually, today is the 4th anniversary of Morgan's body being found.
I know. And
farm.
And I am so sorry for that. You had to wait many agonizing months. But I'm sorry. Please continue.
Well, and again, today was the day that we actually went to Charlottesville and joined with the family of Alexis Murphy, who is missing near Charlottesville, as well
mm-hmm.
as the family of Sage Smith, who a young man who's been missing from Charlottesville for the last year. And we all met on the bridge and you know, had a news conference and talked about the need for coordinated care in finding for missing people. In fact, that's why Jill isn't on the phone tonight. She's actually in Richmond getting ready to speak with the General Assembly tomorrow to attempt to get some bills passed that would fund for coordinated care for missing people in Virginia.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I guess you're finding out the hard way, unfortunately, how difficult it is to get resources when somebody goes missing. Morgan was found 4 years ago today. Let's just to update people that may not be familiar with her case. And we're going to talk with your friend Jane here in just a little bit. She's on hold right now. We'll get with Jane in just a bit. But Morgan was found not off a road, but it was on a large bit of land, but it was like a mile and a half away from a road. Isn't that correct?
That's right. She was found actually kind of on the interior of a large estate, about 6 miles from the arena. And it wasn't as if Morgan's body was just thrown someplace. It took a deliberate plan to get to the interior of this estate. Someone would have had to have known about it. So it's either someone who's worked there, who's hunted there, or something. And so that was really kind of the clue that the police focused on after Morgan's body was found, that, you know, there has to be some connection locally to that farm, because it's just not happenstance that her body was put there.
Do you have, is there any idea in your mind who this might be? I know you can't name suspects, but do they have anybody? I know they have a picture, a drawing out of a possible suspect, but are there any people that you're thinking maybe might know something?
Well, we really don't know. We know that connected to Morgan's case is DNA from a case that occurred in Fairfax, Virginia, in 2005. There was an attack and a rape on a woman by a man, and the DNA from that case matches DNA that was found on Morgan's case. So that's where the picture of what we call sketch came from. Of course, the woman in Fairfax is about 90 minutes from Charlottesville, just outside of Washington. And the woman was of Asian, Indian-Asian descent. It was dark, and it is unclear what the race or the ethnicity of the individual is. And apparently we do not have enough DNA to run the race, so we don't know whether it's African American or whether it could be Hispanic or some other. We have this picture, but we don't have any suspect. And of course, here in Virginia, they have run familial DNA on Morgan's case, and nothing has really come up on that either. Now, you know, here in the Central Virginia area around Charlottesville, Alexis Murphy has been missing now since August 2nd, and has been an arrest in her case, but she has not been found. And just north of Charlottesville, about 30 miles, there is a girl that's been missing now 3 years. And so are these connected, or is it just happenstance, there are four people, you know, who've either been murdered or missing literally within, you know, a 30-mile radius of Charlottesville.
And that is very compelling. That's evidence in itself, in my opinion. Dan, I don't know if you've ever met my co-host, Michael, in Minnesota. Michael, you have a question for Dan Harrington, Morgan's father. Go ahead, Michael.
I did. Well, the question I was going to ask, he just offered, because I had read somewhere in preparation for tonight's show about the DNA match with another victim from 2005. So Dan did speak to that. But in addition, I have a further question, of course, as I always do. I cannot believe the security for the venue where this Metallica concert was occurring. I can definitely understand their reasoning for not wanting to allow people to leave and come back and leave and come back. But a 20-year-old slight-built blonde girl bleeding, obviously in some sort of distress, they must have some culpability or feel some responsibility in the death of your daughter. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's also interesting that on the evening that Morgan was at the arena, now we're talking about an arena that has been built in the last 10 years. There is no video footage of Morgan anywhere, and which is just unbelievable to me in today's time. And near the same time that Morgan was not allowed in the arena, a off-duty policeman who was intoxicated apparently was taken out of the arena and was put in a cab and sent home. And so we have a civil suit against the company that basically runs the arena at this point in time. And, you know, that's percolating through the court system. And we'll have to see where that goes.
I did see reference to that.
That's good. That is ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous that they don't have that. What happened to her? How they wouldn't let her back in? And there's no videotape. Come on, like you said, it was built in less than 10, you know, 10 years or so ago. It's got to that something's
well,
got to change.
And Tricia, the other thing that's so strange is that Morgan is described by people as being confused, and people saw her in the parking lots, and parking lots have to have some security people going through them, and there's no one who has any view of Morgan. There are reports of Morgan being with four of the University of Virginia basketball players, and in fact, three of those four players resigned within a month of Morgan's case. And the police say that they have been cleared. But it seems awfully strange that you have three of your basketball players resign and leave school.
That is a little
odd.
I would not be able to let that one go. Dan, we have a friend of yours on the phone. This is Jane. Jane, you contacted me just shortly right before we are going to go on the air, so I was not able to get a lot of information from you, but you knew Morgan. Is that correct?
Yes, hi, Tricia.
Hi.
I'm Michael Dan.
Tell us how you are involved with Morgan's life and with the Harringtons.
I will. In the spring of 2009, Morgan was my student at Virginia Tech in a plum of a course with only 28 students. So I knew them all by name, and I knew their papers. I knew their sense of humor. I knew where they sat and what they wore, and they all came to my home for dinner. And so I knew Morgan very well. In fact, at the end of our semester, with her shiny A+, she left me with some of her writing because we would tend to, both as artists, do drawings for each other on the work. And I guess the first thing I'd tell you about my beautiful, brilliant, modest, sensitive Morgan is that her last paper was a shrine, you could say, to her parents, to Dan and Jill. This is before I ever knew I would know the Harringtons. I knew Morgan. And she was talking about her values, Tricia, and she said that she remembered as a little girl always jumping on her daddy's lap, and though he was the dean of two medical schools and a doctor with stacks of papers he would bring home. She would push away his work with her grass-stained toes, and not once, never did he ever do anything but accept her embrace and go into the play or the story she wanted.
Aww.
And that her mama, I know, and that her mother, she said that at the core of any imagined shrine, she would have to place a lock of her mother's strawberry blonde hair because, as Morgan said, and as I've said in many talks about her, that her mom was the most spiritual person she has ever known, and that she so wanted to be more and more like her mother because she saw what a beautiful world that made for her mom, and she hoped to be just like her mom. And, you know, the truth is, she already was. And I wish I could tell you how generous she was to her classmates and you know, many of them are still in touch with me. I serve as the faculty advisor for the first campus branch of the nonprofit that Dan and Jill have so beautifully started, Help Save the Next Girl. And we have a branch at Virginia Tech, and, you know, students who knew Morgan and students who only know Morgan's story are very vehement about a grassroots movement to make sure that we alert young women to predatory danger and take care of each other.
That is a beautiful, beautiful story, and not the least bit surprising to me, because what I know of Dan and Jill Harrington is they are so generous and so wonderful, and obviously their daughter Morgan was exactly the same way as her parents, which is just, this whole story is so tragic. Dan Harrington, we're talking about your daughter Morgan, who was missing and then was found murdered, and it's been 4 years, 4 years ago today that you found Morgan's body. What did you do this afternoon to, you touched on it a little bit at the beginning, but you and Jane and a large group of people, along with some other missing family members, you got together and you held a press conference. What exactly did you do?
Well, we held a press conference, as we do every year at this time. This was our fourth press conference on the day Morgan was found, and we presented ourselves along with the Murphy family and Mrs. Smith, who is the grandmother of Sage Smith, who's missing. And so we are three families that are tragically in this club of either murdered or missing people. And we talked with the press because we wanted the public to know that Morgan's case in particular remains unsolved. And we believe that the person who killed Morgan has someone who knows something about that and that they should come forward. There's a $150,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of that person. In addition to that, we asked the police, Virginia State Police, to go back to day one and to review the entire case, because they probably have interviewed the person who has killed Morgan.
Right.
And I think that's a frustration for us, is that, you know, we have limited relationship with Virginia State Police. It's more like a paramilitary organization. They give no information, and they see that the case is theirs and not the family. And so they are quite limited in their responses to us, and that's very frustrating.
Why is that? Can I jump in, Dan? Why is that? For
that,
heaven's sake, I can't understand.
That's the culture.
As the parent of a victim of a violent crime and a possible serial rapist, from what I'm hearing, I don't think that's a stretch to label it as such. I would think you would be entitled to know every move they're making in trying to clear this case. Why are the victims, your victims in and of yourself? I can't understand why they wouldn't treat you with the respect you so aptly deserve.
That's the culture of Virginia State Police. It's quite different from other state polices across the country, and that's how they see things, and that's how they operate. And it's frustrating, you know, they say that the case is still being worked, but, of course, we have no idea what that means. And you know, all we can do is keep this public, and I think that's the amazing thing to us. We also today, four major networks at the bridge taping us, as well as local print media and radio media. And you know, this is how you keep the pressure on people. And fortunately for us, the Harringtons, Morgan's case has been very, very public, and we've received a great deal of support. You know, but you look at the woman Mrs. Smith, whose grandson has been missing for a year and a half in Charlottesville, and she gets no information. She gets no publicity. And so today was an opportunity for her to be able to speak to the press for the really about for the first time. And the Murphy family has been actually has received a fair amount of press about their daughter who's missing, but there is an arrest with a planned trial in May for that for the person who's been indicted for the disappearance and now the murder of what they think the murder of their daughter is, but they have no body, you know, and so that could be a very difficult case to prosecute.
Now, have they checked that perpetrator for DNA to see if there is any match to the 2005 victim and your daughter as well?
Well, the DNA does not match, and he is Caucasian. But that, again, doesn't necessarily mean that there was only one person involved in Morgan's case.
Exactly.
I have a very hard time believing that someone could take Morgan's body and go and take it to the field where she was by themselves. I think it would have been very hard to do. But, you know, we don't know, and, of course, the police will not tell us. And of course, they're also limited in what they're going to say because there's an active, you know, this is an active case for the Murphy family.
Oh, that is just, well, hats off to you, Mr. Harrington, for letting the other families come in, and I'm sure you've opened your hearts to them. Because you know, unfortunately, what they're going through. And like Mark Klass always said, this is one club that nobody wants to be a member of. Let's talk a little bit about your charity organization. And it's called, Help Save the Next Girl, is that what it's called?
That's right. It's Help
Save
the Next Girl.
And what are you doing with that? What are you doing?
It is an organization that is to raise awareness of the need for, particularly for young women, to be aware of their surroundings, to support each other, and to prevent bad things from happening as they have for my daughter. There's a chapter now at Virginia Tech, one at Michigan State, one at Sweetbriar, and there are several high schools where there are chapters. And in this, it's really an educational focus more than anything else, and it's geared from teenage up through college age, primarily women, but there's certainly some men who belong to the organizations as well, and so you know that's a very big focus, particularly for Jill, in that you know she's kind of the leader of that. You know, we've also raised money and built a school in Zambia, Africa, where Jill goes every year to do a medical mission. And so the school's in Morgan's name, and you know, Morgan was going to be a teacher, but she's actually probably going to be able to touch more lives with the things that we've done to try to create something good out of a tragedy than if she would have. If she had lived. And then, of course, the medical school that I work at, we have a scholarship in Morgan's name. She worked with me one summer as a summer intern at the medical school. And so that helps support the pretty significant cost of medical education for a needy student. So we're doing multiple things to try to make an impact in you know in this world in Morgan's name, so that we try to turn something that has been you know a horrendous loss for us into something good.
May I ask something?
I lost my wife, my 20 wife and companion of 25 years, almost 3 years ago to cancer.
Sorry.
And I have not been able to move past my grief in that time. I don't know how people like you and your wife, when your child has not been taken by a natural disease or a horrible disease, but to a violent crime, how in the world do people like you and Mark Klass and all the other parents who get involved, how do you make that leap from the unbelievable grief and rage you must feel at the violence inflicted on your daughter to doing so much good. I need to understand that for my own healing. If you could try to explain that. I can't fathom it. I just can't fathom it.
Well, you know, it's really been interesting to see because as you point out, you know, grief is such a personal thing, and I think, for example, in our situation, Jill and I think grieve differently and at different rates. Mm-hmm. But even as a couple, you have to grieve together, and I think that for us, very early on, we figured out that we would never get over this. But we needed to get beyond it. And to be able to get beyond it, we needed to not have Morgan's memory lost. And that was a really huge thing for us, is to be able to, again, find something good come out of this awful event. And the only way we could do that was to do these activities in Morgan's name. And of course, you know, I think good comes out of that, but it also keeps the focus of Morgan's case out there publicly and for the police. And so it really serves two purposes. And so Jill talks about this so well. She's such a good writer. Actually, there was a blog that I posted on Help Find Morgan, Dana Harrington Facebook page yesterday that Jill wrote, that it's getting beyond this rather than getting over it. You're never going to get over it. And so we grieve and we cry, and you know, and not as much as we used to, but mm-hmm. We just have found that this helps us move beyond where we were.
Mr. Harrington, Dan, I just want to remind everybody who we're talking with. We're talking with Dan Harrington. His daughter, Morgan Harrington, disappeared 4 years ago and was since found murdered. And since then, Dan and his wife, Jill, have done so many things to help others in Morgan's name, to keep Morgan's name alive. Her case is still an active case, however, the Harringtons are not getting much information out of their state police. I'm sure that in other states it's different. Granted, the police have to hold stuff back, but they should at least, for the parents of a murdered child, at least be forthcoming in some way, some sort. Dan, do you have an attorney that maybe could open negotiations with the police, or sometimes that type of pressure, as we know, works?
Well, you know, we actually have not had an attorney specifically for Morgan's case. We do have an attorney for the civil suit, but he has not been involved with Morgan's case. And, you know, early on, obviously, we had more connections with the police because it was for the first 100 days Morgan was missing. So, you know, we were working actively with them to try to find Morgan. But we have talked about that, but I don't know that it would do any good, honestly.
Really, that's just too tough of a wall to crack, huh? That could be. I mean, I don't know. It upsets me, and it's not even my child, and I could imagine what it is doing to you. Hopefully maybe you can find somebody in there that has a bit of a change of heart that can maybe pick up the phone and at least fill you in on a little bit to let you know that something is being done. I want to go back to your friend Jane here. Jane was a teacher of Morgan's. And Jane, what would you like everybody, if you had to say, here's what I want people to remember about Morgan Harrington, what would that something be?
I think I would say that there was nothing about Morgan Harrington that deserved violence. You cannot know how like your own child she was. She was fantastic. She was full of potential and fun. She had great friends. She loved her dog. She loved turtles, and she collected little turtles. She loved, you know, colored glass bottles. They are still on the dresser in her room. She loved great perfume. Morgan was an innocent, and she was full of potential. And I cannot bear the questions, you know, what was she wearing? You know, why was she at that concert? And, Michael, you're right to be frustrated about the no video of Morgan. You know, Morgan tried reentry at three doors. Morgan was stumbling in that, she was stumbling in that cold parking lot for 45 minutes. So as Dan Harrington has so poignantly said before, Morgan had no luck that night. Not one soul stopped her and said, wait a minute, this girl is bleeding, it's cold, she's disoriented, something
is wrong.
She needs
help.
And there was nothing about Morgan, nor about any victim, that deserves violence. We have got to get past the quiet insinuation that things happen to our young women for some ugly reason. They do not. They happen because there are sick perpetrators who are sociopathic and are willing to steal, to abduct, to do violence to these girls. Morgan was innocent. She was fantastic.
It's so heartbreaking. I cannot believe it. And back to you, Dan, you were talking about her being so far a mile and a half off of the road. And how much did she weigh at the time of her abduction? Because
Morgan,
I see what you're saying. You would need two people to carry a body that far unless you were of superhuman strength, I would think.
Right. Well, Morgan probably weighed about 115, maybe 120 pounds. And and it would be very hard for one person to, number one, to get her in the car, to then kill her in what way we don't know, and then to take her body and drive her body actually up the road in front of the mansion that this house is on the estate, open the gate right next to the house, drive down into a valley and leave her body. I mean, it is beyond me that it has to be somebody who knows that area very well.
I agree, and is intimately familiar with that estate.
Yes, yes. I mean, there between the arena and just like any place that's rural. I mean, Morgan could have been just dumped anywhere. You know, I mean, there were plenty of places, even in the 6 miles between the arena and the Anchorage Farm where she was ultimately dumped, that they could have just pulled off the road and pushed her out of the car. But no, it wasn't. We were so lucky that the day that Morgan was found, we had a snowfall the week before, and the man who owns the estate was out looking at his fencing because he wanted to make sure that with the storm that things hadn't occurred, and he thought it was a dead deer, and then he realized it was a human. And if he had not gone out that day, we could be now 4 years into this without a body being found. And I can tell you, although it was so difficult knowing that day that Morgan was dead, it was not as bad as her being missing. That is the worst.
Not knowing.
Because
you
have no concept of what is going on. And, of course, in your own mind, you're bargaining. You know, I mean, is she alive? Is she being, held against her will? Is she cold? Is she wet? You know, and so you just don't know. And so, when Morgan's body was found, it at least allowed us to bring her home.
Yeah. That is. You're right. Not knowing, I'm sure, is an absolute nightmare for any parent to go through. Dan Harrington, tell us how people can get involved to help you and all of the wonderful things that you are doing in Morgan's name. How can people become involved?
Well, I think that there are several things that we have. I would recommend that people go to www.findmorgan.com. That's a website that we set up actually within days of Morgan being taken. And on that page is some of the work that Jill does in Africa. There's her blogs, which are just her writing, I think, is just amazing. And I think it's not just I think it's helpful to people to read how Jill has coped with this. We also have helpsavethenextgirl.com, and that's again another website, you know, which gives information about the organization and how to start a chapter or to become involved. And then, of course, we have the Morgan Dana Harrington Scholarship at Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine. You know, so all of these things are kind of interconnected with one another. So if they go into one of those, you're going to be able to sort of
see
learn
everything
about the various things that we have. Right.
Right. Michael, go ahead. You have a question for Dan Harrington.
I do. Dan, was there any way forensically to tell if Morgan, where her body was found, if that was the site also of the attack? Were they able to say, I'm wondering if she could have walked to that area, obviously under duress, but of her own free will, or is there evidence that it was a place just for a body dump?
I think it was a place for a body dump. Her boots that she was wearing were missing. A piece of jewelry that she has is missing, and the camera that she had was missing. And it would be hard to think that she could have walked, but we don't know whether she was killed there or killed someplace else and then brought there.
Okay.
That is, in itself, the place where she was left is such, to me, such a big clue. You know, like you said, Dan, somebody had to know that area and know it well. And give us the name. It's Help Find Morgan. Was that the name of the website? I apologize.
The website is www.findmorgan.com.
Findmorgan.com.
And that's kind of a compilation of a lot of the information that we have. And then there's helpsavethenextgirl.com, which is the not-for-profit that we have. Those are the two main things.
And are there links on the on each to take you to the other websites?
Yes, there are links on the findmorgan.com that connects to the various other things that we have.
Oh, great. That's great.
You have done such an amazing things in the name of your daughter, and she certainly has wonderful parents. Thank you. And give our best to Jill, please. And
I will.
Dan, if there's anything we can do here at the radio show or at websleuths.com, don't hesitate, because I know there are thousands of people just waiting to help. We're here for you, okay?
We appreciate it. Thank you so much for giving us the time tonight.
I want to speak to your loss. I want to tell you how sorry I am for your unthinkable loss. I can't even imagine what it's like. So my sympathies to you and your family.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And also to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Jane, thank you for joining us and letting us know a little bit about Morgan Harrington, about what she was like in real life. And she is certainly a child that her parents can be very proud of. Thank you both for joining us tonight. Take care.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank
you.
Yes,
what an advocate, Jane. What an advocate.
Oh, yes, thank you, Jane. I mean, what an amazing group. Oops, I'm sorry, I accidentally cut her off. She said, thank you, Michael, for being so nice.
Oh.
But aren't the Harringtons amazing? I mean, they really are. I don't know how they do it. I don't know either.
Like I say it every time. I can't imagine it.
Well, we've had Dan on since, I first started the show in 2011. And even back then, he was he and Jill both were just going, you know, just taking it all on themselves and making sure things changed and trying to get things done. And it was amazing. And I guess that's just what helps people keep their sanity, is to keep busy in the name of their child, to make sure that...
I wonder if there's something about having the person you love taken in violence by some unknown perpetrator, if there's an anger that goes along with that, in addition to the unbelievable sadness, but just a fury that maybe ignites action.
And
I'm
fuels
thinking
it,
that,
yeah,
because I have no one I can blame except for cancer with Nance, mm-hmm. but I'm thinking if there was some nameless, faceless, psychopathic motherfucker out there, I'm sorry, I know we can say anything on Christian
True Crime
Radio, so I will.
I agree.
But I'm wondering if that would help to fuel action or something. I'm just trying to make excuses for my inaction, I guess.
Well, no, I think it would. I think it absolutely would fuel a lot of it, and I think a lot of it is done in anger because you are wanting to get that person. But you know, I'm sure there's different, just like there's different, you know, areas of grief that you go through. I'm sure there's the same way when you have a missing child. You go through different emotions all the time. You know, disbelief, anger, you know, kind of like acceptance, but all of those things probably fuel your emotions into getting something done. But we know there are people out there with missing children that are like I would be, and that is in bed just falling apart. And I'm sure those people need help too. But, that's the thing, Michael. True crime and true crime radio, we could go on 24/7 and we still couldn't get to all of the murders, let alone anything else. But, Michael, you and I, we're going to discuss a topic tonight that you and I both feel strongly about, and that is, it was yesterday the judge said that they could turn off the life support machines for Marlise Munoz. Okay, she was a pregnant woman in Texas, and I can't remember how many weeks along, but she did not have a viable fetus. The fetus could not have lived outside. She had some sort of a blood clot or some medical issue. They're not sure. She was without oxygen to her brain, which meant her baby was without oxygen to its brain for a minute or more. Now, she was brain dead. Just like Jahi McMath, brain dead means you have no activity in your brain. It means you're dead. You're dead. And the state of Texas has a law that says you have to keep a mother alive if she has a viable fetus or a baby, the possibility of a viable fetus. And this poor woman's husband and her family were saying, let us remove her. She never would have wanted this. They were both EMTs. They both knew exactly what they wanted. And the state of Texas was keeping this woman's heart beating. I don't really say alive because she wasn't alive. They're keeping her heart beating. Now, anybody knows that fetus is going to be so damaged beyond repair that it wouldn't be viable. And secondly, finally, Michael, I don't know if you're aware of this, they did remove the life support and the body has been released to her husband. What are your thoughts on it, Michael?
Oh, I was outraged from the beginning. I am no longer an HLN viewer for countless reasons, but so I've switched over to CNN, and I'm an Anderson Cooper-aphile. But they've had Sonny Hostin and Mark Garagos on as their legal analysts discussing this case. And Sonny Hostin has played the role of the federal prosecutor, and she's been pro this entire hospital stance that the law is so murky. You cannot say that the mother who absolutely said, I never want to be on life support, ever took into consideration the fact, unless I'm pregnant, does the same hold true? But at the time, she had a blood clot in her lung, actually, and that's why she collapsed. And there, she was legally brain dead. They do not know how long without the baby went without oxygen. And at the time of her collapse, it was not a viable fetus. She was only 16 months along.
16
but
weeks.
Because they've kept 16 weeks, excuse me. And so, because of the hospital, they've kept her on. By the time they were finally in court, of course, it had been 6 weeks, I believe, since she actually collapsed. So mm-hmm. apparently, in the last Anderson Cooper I saw, they had come out with reports on the fetus's condition there was such malformity below the waist that a sex could not even be determined. And they were able to tell that it was not going to be a viable fetus. So there was extensive swelling on the brain, and so it was clear at that point that they were not dealing with a fetus that was viable outside the womb. And so I think that's, well, apparently the judge who ruled in the case ruled strictly on the fact that the law talks about the patient as keeping the patient alive, and the patient in this case is brain dead, which is dead in every 50 of our 50 states.
Yes.
So the fact she was pregnant didn't matter. And thank God. I mean, it was the only humanitarian thing to do. Mark brought up a good point. Mark Garagos, he said, so, Sonny, to carry your reading of this law through, you're saying anyone who presents as dead needs to undergo an emergency pregnancy test, and if they're pregnant, put them on life support. It's just ludicrous. And, of course,
absolutely,
she had her answer. I don't like Sonny Hoff, and I can say that on Trisha's Two Time Radio, too.
Yes, you can. You can say whatever you want there. That's the beauty of it. We have nobody watching. We can say, we can swear, we can even do the show in the nude if we feel like it. By gosh. Anyway, I agree with you. It was a tragic case all around. But, you know, I think you have to also look and use your common sense. Here you have the woman's family. This is their daughter. And you have the husband, and they're both in the medical field. Come on, you know, let them go. I don't know why Texas has that law. That's just absolutely ridiculous. You can't, you know, we could go on and on for this forever, let alone about true crime. But you're right, Michael, it needed to be done. The machines have been turned off. She is being prepared for a funeral. I don't know when or any of the details, but that's what needed to happen, and it did, and thank goodness.
Get this, Trisha, now. Who is going to be responsible for her medical bills up to this point? Do you think they're going to bill that poor husband?
Better not be the husband, because he didn't want it. Let the state pay for it. They're the ones that wanted it. You know, if I was made king and could make all the rules, that's what I'd say. I'd say, hey, this is what you wanted. You do not dare. You know, his insurance isn't going to pay for that. They're not going to pay for a dead person to be on life support. It's just, they just won't. So that's a very good point, Michael. I bet they'll try.
I'll bet money he'll start getting bills for this.
And I hope he comes right to the media, because let the people who were screaming that she needed to be kept on life support while dead, you know, let them help pay, or let the state do it, because the state was the one that was the roadblock here. So they're the ones that need to pony up the bucks. Oh,
that's
Michael,
how I feel about it.
It was a great show today. Thank you so much for everything. And next
I
week,
have one
I,
thing else I want to speak to, Trisha, if that's okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, I follow Twitter, and I noticed that there is a Twitter account. It's called Jody Arias Needle. And they, of course, are Travis Alexander's and Justice for Travis Alexander supporters. Of course, everyone knows that that's the camp I'm in. But they are calling for a fundraiser to help the family. And I have written to Samantha, but I have not heard back from her. But I just want to caution guests about, or any one of our listeners, about contributing to unknown groups claiming that they are raising money for a family when we haven't had verification that they have any connection to the family. I just don't want anyone fleeced of their hard-earned money. So they very well could be legitimate, but I'm just putting it out there that think twice before you give your money to anyone claiming that they have an inside track to a certain victim's family, because I would hate to see anyone taken.
Right. At the very least, and I'm talking in generalities here, the family needs to come out and say, yes, we support this person. They are with us, and what they're doing is legit. If you don't have that, don't do it. Absolutely, just don't do it. You know, and then if the family comes out, then that's up to you. You know, but you have to realize that, you know, if it's not a 501(c) charity, when you donate your money, it just goes to the family, and that's okay too. Nothing wrong with that. So just be careful when you're donating online to people, because there are some great people out there with big hearts who do want to do the right thing, and then there are just real true scumbags. And, boy, we've seen that too here, haven't we,
right,
Michael?
Ugh,
absolutely. Just awesome. Well, Michael, thank you very much. We'll have another show again next week. Don't forget my new true crime show. It's on the iHeartRadio.com network. You need to go to iHeartRadio.com and then look up Extreme Talk. Extreme Talk, and that will be me, okay?
I want to tell everyone listening, your shows have been so outstanding on that network. I cannot believe, and I see great things happening for you in the future. So professional, absolutely wonderful. You've just rocked it. And
I hope for great successes for you.
Yeah, absolutely the best.
It's fun. It's different than this show. It's a lot different, but it's really, really fun. This show's fun, too. This is like my fun playground. But that show is the one that I'm hoping will get picked up. So let's keep our fingers crossed. Michael, you are such a doll. Thank you for everything and your great support. And we'll talk to you next week, okay?
Okay. Thanks so much, Tricia.
Take care, everybody. Okay, first of all, do remember this, okay? It is Tricia's True Crime Radio, excuse me, and opinions expressed on this show are those of the hosts and guests. Do remember that Tricia's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuth.com LLC and ForumsForJustice.org. And today's show is sponsored by the wonderful people at Pause for Purple Hearts in Palo Alto, California. Pause for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind to offer therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder to train service dogs for their comrades. Excuse me. So go to www.pauseforpurplehearts.org. Okay, that's it. It's Tricia's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.